logical system.
Well, again, I think looking for the absurd is what gets these guys money. You know, they book speaking engagements and magazine articles and book deals. And if they kind of tell you that they basically hook people up to electromyograms and do brain scans of people, it's a little less scary than what they usually describe as the interest of, you know, for some odd reason, as you mentioned, you know, the Greys, the aliens, very popular in the 50s, were very focused on the GI track of human beings for some strange reason.
Keep in mind, it's not that different from all the wild animals who they can have full access to and nobody would care. You know, the lower digestive system.
Well, yeah, but back then they were also mutilating cows and such, so they had that part covered at least.
We mutilate cows. It's called a butcher shop.
Well, I don't know. Is that really considered a mutilation? I kind of consider it a disassembly.
All semantics.
I guess. So usually when people mutilate something, they usually thankfully don't eat it. Dahmer is the exception to the rule, I guess. Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, one other item from about 15 minutes ago.
Certainly.
You said you wonder about what would happen if you had visibility in the future. Several science fiction shows have addressed that in what I think is a very interesting way. There was a movie that at first description sounds absolutely terrible, but it really was actually a good movie called The Final Countdown, where a modern aircraft carrier goes through a time warp and ends up off Hawaii just before the Pearl Harbor attack. And, spoiler alert, they failed to stop it. But it turns out one of the officers, who's a history buff, gets left behind. And then when the ship goes back to the time warp, to modern times, and returns to port, my hero gets off and someone says, "Mr. So-and-so, which is a big deal." He walks into a big limo. And it's his old, you know, his old friends who got left behind. With his knowledge of what happened from 1941 to the present day, he became a multi-billionaire.
Yeah, they kind of use the same thing for Back in the Future. One of the characters discovers a sports a book with the record of wins, loses, and what have you, and goes back in time and makes enough sports bets to become a multimillionaire, opens a gambling joint, and that was Back in the Future, Back to the Future 2, I think. Anyway, yeah, I love time travel science fiction. The logic involved gives me a headache, as well it should, because there's a whole bunch of things that are impossible to have happen, but it makes for great writing. In the right hands.
On that point, the Back to the Future series of three movies so successful was the other stuff. They didn't just keep it right to the story. They added fascinating, you know, side plots and the like the one you mentioned, and a lot of cute puns and the like, and jokes. A time travel movie that takes itself too seriously is more of a disaster.
I don't know. It depends on the writing, ultimately. You can do a comedic time travel. You can do a serious time travel. I have seen more sitcom type of sci-fi shows where they go back in time to kill Hitler. It's a meme almost. There was someone else who is trying to get in. Let's give a pause to the repeater and give an opportunity for the other person.
KD2VHD, Jim.
Oh, okay, Jim. What do you got to say?
A thought. For what it's worth. I'm not a great big logician or whatever the term would be. But if you could know the future, you would be doomed not not to be able to influence it. I know I've influenced the future in small little ways and things that I've interacted with people and taught them and brought them together and whatnot. And I don't know what that leads to. But if you could know the future, wouldn't that preclude your ability to influence it? And so we've evolved into the philosophy net. Sorry.
I have an opposing viewpoint.
Okay, we will hear your opposing viewpoint. I just want to put in my two cents. I mean, that's one of the big philosophical things that you could talk about and never come to any conclusion. Is the future fated? Is there any way to change the fate of us all? I could use one of my favorite movies, Terminator. Kind of played both sides of that equation. In some of the movies, you could change the future, and in other versions, you couldn't. So that's a good philosophical question that you could make a lot of money talking about because no one has the faintest idea what the answer is. But what do you got to say, Ed?
One way you can change the future is when you pull over somebody who's about to make the same mistake you once made, and you try to set them straight, and they refuse to listen. And this happened to me as recently as yesterday. Is that enough of a point, Roy, or should I go off topic a little for about 1 minute?
Well, it's always good listening to you going off topic. I would not call that changing history. I would call that affecting history. And unfortunately, I've been there myself. I think everyone listening has. There are some people in this world that will not take advice, that will not learn from the results that other people found and have to make the error themselves before they learn their lessons.
To take off on my flight of fancy for 60 seconds?
Yes, you are.
Yesterday, I was at an outdoor Boy Scout event. And there is one thing coming up on the Boy Scout calendar that I've done in the past. There is a thing where they sometimes have an organized activity up in the Catskills in February, where you can set your watch by the fact it's going to be 15 degrees during the day, 0 degrees at night, 2.5 feet of snow on the ground, and a good chance when you're trying to sleep in your tent, there's a good stiff wind and falling snow. And in a word, this is brutal. I've done it a number of times, and the key point is you have to build up to it. You have to be fully prepared emotionally, equipment-wise, everything. And if you don't, it will be horrible. And I know some people who are going to go next month, and I was trying to warn them of what I've learned, and it bounced off of them like bullets off of Superman's chest.
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way. That's the nature of people. That's one of the many things that kind of infuriates me. You know, there are some people that you cannot offer advice to. It's just physiologically impossible.
Oh, comment.
Okay, Jim, comment away.
Ed's story is excellent. There's a synopsis to it that I've heard, and it comes back to me. And it's just this. It is a fool that only learns from his own mistakes.
Well done.
Yep, I agree, but there's a lot of fools out there, unfortunately.
And to tell you the truth, some don't even learn from their own mistakes.
Yeah, there are guys who I am amazed that the modern technology has safety-proofed so many different things. Sometimes I'll hear about something that someone tried to do and didn't get himself killed, and I'd say, you know, if this happened 100, 200 years ago, he'd be dead. You know, I mean, This world of ours is much safer than it once was.
Oh, that segues to something else. Very quick.
Okay.
They say that insanity is trying the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And my retort is two words, Microsoft Windows.
Well, yeah. So sometimes you just keep banging at the wall, and eventually the wall will break through. Usually that quote is misquoted to Einstein. Almost every major quote is not from the person that the guys usually tell you it's from. But that one usually I've heard attached to Einstein, but there's no proof that he ever said anything like that. But, yeah.
I do have a favorite Einstein quote.
Certainly. I have one sitting. I got a picture of the old man with a quote of his that I think really is legitimately a quote of his. But please, feel free.
Relativity is at its core. That until Einstein developed relativity, time was considered absolutely, unchanging. Time is time. Period. And Einstein's brilliant move was, wait a minute, maybe time isn't fixed. I might explain a lot of stuff, and that's what relativity is. And he once said, why are you so upset about variations in time? I find when I'm talking to a pretty girl, time goes much faster than when I'm sitting on a hot stove.
Yep. That was the whole break with Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics had an enormous flaw. It required a fundamental frame of reference for the universe. And that was the basis of a consistent time and a consistent space measurement. A foot in one environment was supposed to be the same foot in another environment, no matter what. And that ultimately fell apart because it broke too many rules. And so space and time are relative to other factors. Time goes at different rates in different areas. Our sense of what's happening right now is kind of different with different frames of reference. So, yeah, it's I love Albert. My quote on the wall is, I have no special talents, I am only passionately curious.
Oh, that was a recurring. He also said something like, I never grew up. I developed adult reasoning while still maintaining a childish curiosity, and that's where my success comes from.
Well, I mean, that's very important. That unfortunately is why most fundamental physics discoveries happen to relatively young people. Of course, a lot of people break the rule. Max Planck, I think, was 50 when he did Planck's equation, he's considered the grandfather of quantum mechanics. I hate the phrase think outside the box. But you sometimes you get limited by your experience and your expertise in a field where you can't imagine anything but what you've been teaching for many, many years. So that's true. Great man, brilliant man, little weird around the edges. He married his cousin. I don't know what to make of that, but great man. Not a great mathematician. He basically borrowed mathematics from Lorentz and other great mathematicians, but brilliant mind, nevertheless. I think Stephen Hawking was a little bit better at both mathematics and theoretical physics, probably on the same level with theoretical physics. He was a little bit better with mathematics than Albert was. Jim, did you want to say something?
Not at this point. Soon, but I'm enjoying the conversation.
Okay, very good. Well, you know, my appreciation for physicists who revolutionized. I mean, the field of physics was a mess in the late 19th century. Everything was falling apart and breaking down, and people had a lot of contradictions that they could not possibly explain. They tried to use variations on old mechanic ideas, vortex math, and all kinds of foolish things. They built beautiful interferometers, which we use to this day, to discover gravitational waves, but they were using it to prove the reality of ether. That was supposed to be the substance that electromagnetic waves propagated through. Unfortunately for them, ether doesn't exist. So, you know, thank God for all these quantum mechanic guys, who other old-time physicists were not particularly pleased with. They thought quantum mechanics was weird. They thought that it was just being made up. There was a lot of anti-Semitism back in those days. So, you know, in Germany, there was a lot of talk about Jewish physics, disparagingly. So, interesting times.
Never mind. Oppenheimer.
No, it's on my list of things I want to watch. The limitation is I think it's 3 hours. I don't know if I got that patience.
Okay, the SYL plays the different things like Netflix and the like. Like Typhus plays the violin. And one Saturday night when we didn't have any plans, the two of us watched it for $5 or something. We watched it on television. Yeah, we missed having the real piece of sound, surround sound and two screen when the bomb went off. But other than that, no doubt about it. Here's why I brought it up. There was one line that you alluded to not realizing. They're saying, how do we know the Germans aren't ahead of us? And the answer is, very deep down the rabbit hole business. And then one guy says, and don't forget the Jewish effect. Huh? The Germans threw out all their Jewish businesses and that gutted their system. You can't ignore that.
Yes, yes. Thankfully, the constant in the universe seems to be that fascists are idiots. Incompetent, stupid idiots. And to this day, they seem to demonstrate that odd behavior. So yeah, they shot themselves in the foot in more ways than one. I don't know. Tell me, does the Oppenheimer movie touch upon good old Richard Feynman at all? You know, I think he was just a graduate student at the time, helping out and playing a bunch of jokes like breaking into high security combination locked safes and such.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've read a number of books about it. I can't say I've seen any movies about it because they never made any. But the answer to your question is simply no. They did not go into a lot of stuff I was wondering about. And that one I wasn't even really wondering about. I didn't think they would make it.
Oh, well, it would have been amusing. Yeah, I've read a lot of Feynman's books and his lecture papers. He did a series of lectures that were so obscure, unfortunately, that the only people that I understand attended were the graduate students and the faculty. The undergraduate students couldn't make hide nor hair of it. And it's available out there any place. If you Google Feynman lectures, there's PDF files full of them.
Familiar with all of that, and I agree 100%. I'm a big fan of Feynman. But I think my best Feynman story is very simple. Anyone can understand it. But let me get that one man. Oppenheimer. The big snub was Harold Everett. Got no credit. All right? Anybody know who Harold Everett was?
Unfortunately, I don't. Was he one of the military guys who was trying to control and get things done?
No. Here's the point. They rapidly figured out there were two approaches, uranium and plutonium. Uranium was very, very, very hard to get, but easy to detonate. The plutonium was much easier to make, but much harder to detonate. And the reason was, you had to have a sphere of plutonium, up the size of a basketball, and it had to be imploded symmetrically with tremendous force. The force had to be absolutely spherically symmetrical, or it all blow out one side and just make a huge mess. And Harold Nemirov was the lead on coming up with the sphere of explosives outside the actual bomb that would cause it to symmetrically implode with enough force to keep it in place for the explosion. Any comments before you're on to item two?
Okay, that was very, very important. It was not as glamorous, but it was very important. And, yeah, you have to reach a critical mass for an explosion, and you have to hold that critical mass together as long as you can to get the biggest payoff. You know, otherwise you're just spraying radioactive material in a much smaller radius. So, yes, that was why I always was confused as a child when they called it an implosive device, even though it looked like it was exploding to me. They were talking about the ignition system at the time.
By the way, Nemirov was not a popular guy among the residents of Los Alamos, because he would go out to the desert at all hours of the day and night to try his ideas, and his ideas invariably involved setting off about 100 pounds of high explosives. And that would carry for miles and miles. So everybody would be minding their own business when kaboom. And they'd say, oh, there goes never ever again. All right, second item.
Yep.
Feynman's most interesting story, I think, is the least technical. Feynman was terminally ill with cancer. And he just was, you know, trying to be comfortable for his last days. He gets a call. They want him to participate in the investigation for what happened to the Challenger space shuttle that exploded. And he says, you realize I'm dying, don't you? And he says, well, can you sit in a room? He says, of course. He says, well, think of it. What a way to go out. If we could figure out what happened to the Challenger. He says, go on. And he was the one who came up with the idea with the Brill Loader.
Yeah, yeah, it's a famous story, O-rings.
My point is, talk about a zombie apocalypse.
Okay, but unfortunately he wasn't cured. He was just unfortunately dying. Great guy, jeez. And a far Rockaway guy, you know. I mean, if you heard him talk, you would not think a physics professor. You would think some guy in Far Rockaway.
Summer of 1958, I was 12 years old, spent a lot of time in Far Rockaway. I might have brushed up there.
It's possible. I think I did a story on him way, way back for some reason. And, he started out repairing radios. He never became a ham. You know, usually when I tell a story about Feynman fixing radios and such to make money, you know, before he went off to college, people kind of generally think he could have been a ham, but he wasn't. But clever guy. Little crazy, but you know, you have this theory that smart people have to be a little crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that reminds me of a personal story. Nowhere near on that level. But the teenagers who played with building their own radios in the 30s it paid off of them big time.
Well, again, it depends. I'm sure some of them went on to great things, but, you know, others went on to completely different things. You know, Barry Goldwater, you know, went on to threatening to nuke half of South Asia. So you could go in different directions, fortunately or unfortunately.
No, you missed my point completely. In his teenage years, my dad dabbled with radio and the like. Then comes World War II. He gets drafted. In boot camp, they gave him all kinds of aptitude exams. And because of his knowledge of radio, that showed in the exams. And instead of being handed a rifle, they sent him to radar school. And he ended up as a radar technician, which could very well have saved his life.
Yeah, that's very possible. But, you know, I mean, they could have just put him in generic Signal Corps. And, you know, unfortunately, Signal Corps guys got shot at as well. They I don't think they had guns, but, you know, they had to set up the lines of communication. So, you know, but in your father's case, he was fortunate and good for him. You know, I mean, radar, that's another great invention. You know, who would have thunk it, you know, 5 or 6 years before it ever came to fruition? The British were popularizing that they were giving their pilots carrots to improve their night vision to try and use as a reason for why the unknown radar was being more effective than usual pilots were effective.
I have something to say, but first I think Jim double you for a sec.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Jim, please.
Oh, continue on. I was just cheering the crowd. I love the conversation. Go ahead.
Want to hear a really, really, really great story about radar?
Okay.
I have seen this from several sources. I have a book in the other room. If you care, I can get you the author and title. And I blundered into something. I have weird stuff on my smartphone, and there was something on this on YouTube that basically paralleled me. Quiz. Which is more hotel from World War II? The atomic bomb or the cavity magnetron?
I would guess the cavity magnetron.
Anybody disagree in the audience?
I'm thinking the M1 Garand, but I haven't had a Cavitron in my my. Go on. That's fine.
Yes, Patton said the M1 Garand was the greatest battle implement ever developed. And yes, he was right. I will tell you. Certainly those three are way up there. The atomic bomb, the cavity magnetron, a military-grade semi-automatic rifle. A lot of people don't realize this. The only one for most of World War II was the U.S. M1 Garand. The other countries, until the end of the war, were all using bolt-action rifles. But here's my point. That without the magnetron, you can't put a radar in an airplane with the technology available during World War II. And putting radars in airplanes made a tremendous difference. What my father, who I mentioned before, was actually working on, he was sent to a B-24 base in Italy to maintain the squadron, get this, radar bomb sites. They went away from the northern optical bomb site to radar bomb sites, and my father was maintaining them from the base. She still came home with PTSD, as my wife many, many decades after the fact diagnosed, but that was another story to another time. And also, the so-called night fighters and the like, not having to use searchlights or anti-aircraft like they were. In the Battle of Britain, the chain home radar system was just to detect stuff coming across the channel. It was not useless for targeting. They had to use stuff like, you know, searchlights and the like, whereas radar was going to roll ahead with that, not required magnetrons, right?
Yeah, amazing inventions, and it's kind of incredible how long they were able to keep it quiet, because a lot of people worked on it. I mean, sure, there was a war in the middle of it that kind of blocked the spies a little bit, but still, the fact that they kept it secret for as long as they did still amazes me.
And by the way, the M1 Garand did have one reason.
Yes.
Oh, it had a few more weaknesses than one. It's a very, very interesting nuanced story, but go on, Ed.
Are you talking about M1 or something?
No, there's so many interesting... That story, we could go on for weeks on that, so we won't. But you go ahead.
If a soldier was in one-on-one combat, the rifle swapped in a sheet metal slip with 8 rounds of ammo. And when you fired the 8th round, there would be a little boing as the sheet metal slip got ejected. And it close, you know, in the middle of a big battle, no big deal. But if it was like one-on-one, stuff like that, if the enemy hears that boing, he knows you've got a couple of seconds while you reload. Was that you trying to sound like the clip coming out of an M1?
No, that's an actual clip from an M1 hit with a piece of metal.
It didn't come across right. I know what it really sounds like. It didn't come across right.
So, there's no doubt it makes a very distinctive loud sound, and I think it had no difference in any interaction between M1 Garand and other things, because there was way more louder things going on most of the time. But definitely a very characteristic feature of that machine.
Well, 99.9% of the time, there's dozens if not hundreds of people shooting simultaneously, so that was a non-issue.
What an amazing history of technology and people and development of machinery and technology. The story is huge. I've learned about it for years, and I still can learn more every day.
Oh, here, Roy, here's one to do for a pure scientist. You ready?
Yep.
Machine guns, which had fully automatic fire, were perfected before World War I. It took another 30 years to perfect a weapon that fired only one shot at a time, that you had to release the trigger and then pull it again for the second shot. That took like 30 years after developing fully automatic fire. Wouldn't you think that... I assume you know nothing about the subject. Does that sound completely counterintuitive?
Yes, to me it would be. I'm sure there's some nuanced mechanical aspect. Do you know one of the guys who patented a multi-fire gun? Whose son we know of to this very day?
Yeah, don't bring that up. It brings up bad memories. I knew a fellow. He was on this net. I don't want to bring him up. But he insisted to me that Hiram Maxim Sr. invented the only design of machine gun that everybody else copied. And I couldn't tell him no. There were about 50 different designs of machine guns that came out all over the world at about the same time, just in time for World War I.
Well, yeah, but I think actually it even predates World War I. They were killing people in Africa with those types of weapons before World War I.
It goes back to the Gatling gun, which is sort of a quasi-machine gun that came out, I believe, at the end of the Civil War. But, I mean, it was a huge, huge, you know, it was the development of, you know, machine guns. It was a long, slow process, but it took years and years more to perfect the semi-automatic, which I find mind-boggling, although nothing is impossible for the man who doesn't have to do the job.
Yeah, it's odd, but Hiram's daddy made a lot of money off of that patent. He wasn't the only one. I mean, you know, it's sort of the same nonsense when people argue that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. He didn't invent the light bulb. He pretty much perfected the design in general use, which still buys you a lot of profits of money, if not the glory of having started from nothing.
That brings up a subject that might even be relevant to the technical net.
Yes?
DC versus AC power. That was a big deal in the day. And I think it's actually really very simple.
Yes?
Well, you gotta realize you're in that control. I'm taking with you to make sure I don't go running off. Alright, here we go. Edison was kind of short-sighted. He figured he would build a generation plant to power the neighborhood. But he stubbornly refused to admit there was economies of scale to build a large power plant that would serve a large area. The problem is you cannot run DC through a transformer. And drill equals IR. If you think about it for a minute, the higher the voltage, the lower the current, the less money you're paying on copper to send electricity a long distance if you raise the voltage. Basically, conductors are cheaper than insulators. But you don't want to put 30,000 volts into your light bulbs. So you had to send the power at high voltage if you're doing any real difference and step it down. And you can't do that with DC. And I think Edison was just too bullheaded to admit that.
I don't know. I mean, it's a famous argument he had. But it was him and GE/Tesla. And he would go on these showcases of the dangers of high voltage alternating current, and he would electrocute elephants and such to demonstrate how terribly dangerous high voltage AC was. I think it's just that he bet on the wrong horse, and he threw good money after bad, like many people tend to do.
Zombie apocalypse time, you ready?
Okay.
I've been hit with both the AC and DC. They feel the same. Thankfully, it never once has the pain to the point of, ouch.
Okay, but I mean, the point of the exercise is, as you mentioned, if you're running DC, you're not stepping up the voltage. There's no cheap method of doing that. So you're not getting thousands of volts of a potential difference. You're getting whatever the generator wants to put out to your appliances. So I don't know if the big danger in Edison's presentation was the difference between, say, alternating and direct. I think it was primarily high voltage versus kind of medium voltage potentials.
I have some real world information for you.
Okay.
I have done a lot of work in the power industry. I've worked with a lot of the electricians and the like. And let me tell you, up to 240 volts, which is the most you're going to find in a house, if you get hit, your muscles jump instinctively. Above 1,000 volts, if you get hit, you're physically thrown away from it. 480 will kill you because your muscles clamp down.
Okay, but probably it depends upon your posture, your position, how you take that voltage. If you take that voltage on a swipe, it's less dangerous than if you, say, fall into it.
Yeah, of course. But this is like, you know, all the electricians I've spoke to of cumulative experience.
Oh, okay. I mean, thankfully, I've never really... I mean, when I was a little kid, my parents let me fix television sets. So that was probably a dangerous thing to do for a kid in the fifth grade, but I survived it. But in general, as far as I can recall, the worst hit I got was 120 volts, which I wouldn't want to have happen again, but I survived that as well.
230 AC in a Con Edison substation. 500 DC off the plate of an 807.
Good, a 500 must have hurt.
Hold on, Jim. No, it felt exact. They all felt exactly the same. Jim?
From what I understand, and I've kept an eye on this for, you know, a better part of a half a century, is there are certain voltages and modes, you know, that will throw you, and there are certain voltages that will cause you to clamp onto what you just grabbed like a vice grip. And hence, then you get current through you and your demise is imminent. I don't recall exactly what the characteristics are of this particular voltages and whether AC, DC, I forget what it is. But there are certain characteristics that are far more likely to meet your demise than others. Most of the time we repel from the thing, but others not so much.
Conventional wisdom among electricians is avoid 480 at all costs.
Wise words, but I mean, look, if you got bad luck, it's, you know, everything's out the window. I mean, I think I read about 7 years ago of some poor, unfortunate fool who died from a 9-volt transistor battery.
No, that's physically impossible. I can tell you a version of that story that is realizable, although I don't know the truth.
Okay, I mean, ultimately it has to do with the currents going anywhere near your heart. You know, if you could somehow finagle a relatively low voltage potential close enough to your heart to screw up your pacemaker, then you punched that ticket.
I will tell you,
I think there's some contributors trying to get in right.
If you take a 9-volt battery and you lick your lips and you touch it to your upper lip under your nose, you will definitely feel it tingle, but it's nowhere near a shock. You say, oh, yeah, it's tingling. And I heard a story, I have no idea if it's true, about some guy wanted to try and experiment with a car battery and a bucket of salt water and managed to kill himself.
Well, isn't he a silly, silly man? Now, someone wants to break into our little conversation, so let's all stay quiet for a little while and listen.
KC2, SHO.
Hello, John.
Yeah, here at the lab, I'm a electrical safety officer. So we go through pretty extensive training here, and you know, DC isn't an issue for the LetGo thing. It's AC only. AC signals can have the can cause the non-LetGo, and there's a threshold of obviously frequencies and voltages. But the real key is, yeah, almost anything with enough current, because it really is the current can kill you if it gets past to the heart, you know. Your blood is much like salt water, so if you can get past the skin barrier, which is really the insulator here, yeah, I guess it's completely feasible that a 9-volt could do it. But it does sound highly unlikely, but there could be enough current there. It'd be interesting to know what kind of studies have been done about that. But I think I recall pretty vividly Dick Nadel talking about the salt water and the blood thing, and the people who went in their basements during the flood, during Sandy, and maybe their skin got too wet and they lost their ability to stand off the voltage and ended up dying from that.
Yeah, I remember that theory. He mentioned it more than a few times, that some of the deaths were unreportedly caused by electrocution, by the power getting in to the groundwater that they were then walking around in, that somehow there was enough of a current to end up killing them. And no one knew enough to figure that one out.
Oh, I have two more things.
Okay.
Well, one says a 9-volt battery. Usually, I do, I think most people do, think of one of those little rectangular, quote, transistor radio, unquote, from back in the day batteries. I do not believe they are capable of doing that because they just don't have the ultimate. It's very small, has a fairly high internal resistance, and with any kind of a load, the voltage sags tremendously. Totally different tack. There's a big thing now with electricians and work with this, having to do with swimming pools. The big thing now everybody is very worried about and working on defenses against, if somehow there's a leakage path of electricity into a swimming pool, and that can be fatal. It's very, very rare, but when it happens, watch out.
Yeah, I mean, these things are very dangerous. Let me break for a second and make sure I'm not stomping on someone. Okay, very good. I mean, I've mentioned it before. When factories first became electrified, the people working in them tried to demand hazard pay because they were frightened a great deal from electricity. In that case, overfrightened, although probably all things being equal, it's probably better to be overfrightened than underfrightened, because overfrightened just makes you mildly upset, and underfrightened can make you dead. But, electricity can kill people. We're very fortunate, us hams, that we live in solid-state times. Most of the power that we play around with are not terribly high-voltage potential. My linear amplifier runs at, I think, 50 volts. It uses LDMOS power transistors and such. So we live in a safer world today.
Brings up something that's very, very relevant to what I say on Earth here.
Sure.
Some of the newer hams decide they want to stop playing with some of the boat anchors. And I tell them, be very, very, very careful. If you're working on modern rings, they're mostly running off of 12 volts, and you can play with them in unity. Those boat anchors have voltages that can theoretically kill you. Do not make that mistake.
N2VH, Steve Mulfield with a comment.
Yep, sure.
You mean me?
Yes, welcome back.
Okay, thank you. I went into the black hole of Nebraska for a while. Thank you. Oh, how about, what's relevant, how about a electrical surgical unit? Most people don't know what it is, but you as an internist, probably, I'm in a biomedical engineer. Perhaps you can explain. I could, but I don't want to hog the net. Could you explain how it runs on 1 megahertz, or sometimes half a megahertz, is 100 watts, and people are both, well, people are always unconscious when this thing takes contact with your skin. An electrical surgical unit. Over to you.
Well, it sounds like you probably have more expertise, Ken, than I do. I rotated through surgery, but I'm a general internist. So I try and stay away from the surgeons and the anesthesiologists.
Okay, it's a radio knife. They use it in all of the operating room. They cut you open with a radio knife. And different modes, bipolar and so forth, and it'll use 100 watts at either a half or 1 megahertz. And it'll cauterize you while it cuts at the same time. It's not sharp. It looks like a knife, but it uses RF to cut you open. I just calibrated 3 of them the other day. That's why I was fresh in my mind. What do you think about that? Back to net control.
Well, as we mentioned earlier in the technical net, technology has improved greatly over the many years. I'm sure they still use scalpels often. You'll have to tell me if this is a thing of the past. You know, I haven't visited an operating room in probably 30 years, so what do I know these days? But yeah, they're using lasers, especially for ophthalmological procedures. Lasers are the cutting instrument of choice. So all these technologies that didn't exist 30 years ago.
Alpha Delta 2 golf uniform.
Yes. Yes, Alpha Delta 2 golf uniform. Would you like to say something?
I mean, those 9 volts could actually kill somebody if it's resonant with their, if this disrupts the electrical circuits in their brain. I'm not sure if anybody agrees with that or not.
That's a bit more problematic. The brain is an electrochemical device, and if you disrupt it, they give electroshock therapy, unfortunately, that people survive. So an electrical shock to your head can confuse you, can screw your brain. Usually, you know, it could maybe suppress your respiratory centers, but long haul, it's far less dangerous than an electrical current around your heart, because the AV node is the built-in pacemaker for our hearts. And if you jam it when it's external electrical potential, it stops beating regularly, and that can cause a cascade failure through your entire body.
You said that a lot better than I could. Also, the little shocks, like you said, can disrupt your brain and your heart. What is the current going through, or voltage going through those defibrillators that can bring people back?
Well, they don't really, as far as I recall, it isn't a measurement of voltage potential. It's a measurement, because the thing that really affects you is the amount of charge, the amount of energy. So defibrillators have settings for joules, which I think are watt seconds. And usually something like 50 to 100 joules with some paste on the chest wall is what they use to cardiovert people.
I have a comment on that.
Certainly.
I think one of the dangers of electrical shock is that to start ventricular fibrillation by 50 to 100 milliamps through the heart. And I can't prove this, but I believe that the idea of a defibrillator is to put about 50 to 100 mils through the heart. The reason why you have to be very, very careful not to give it to somebody who doesn't really need it is it can cause as well as stop ventricular fibrillation. And it does remind me of the old joke from some 1930s spooky comedies where, you know, somebody getting bopped on the head loses his memory and another bop on the head gets it back. And it's unfortunately reminiscent of that. But do you understand my point, Roy?
AC2GS. Yeah, I get your point, Ed. And cardioverting, it depends. It's recommended to attempt cardioversion even if you have no heartbeat. Asystole is what that's called. But certainly if you have ventricular tachycardia, a very irregular pattern, zapping someone is sort of like attempting to restart an engine. You kind of knock it out of commission entirely, and then you hope that it just starts up again. Sometimes it works, sometimes, unfortunately, it doesn't.
Like Windows was restarting it.
Yeah, but much more serious, I guess. Yeah, it's, television always screws it up because it's inconvenient for them, so you'll see people put the paddles on their clothing and not apply conductive gel and all kinds of weird things.
So I have AED training, and that would be ridiculous.
Yeah, well, again, you know, dramatic license. I'm sure professionals all over the place notice a whole bunch of things that story writers get away with.
I've seen dozens, maybe hundreds.
Yeah, someone said comment.
Jim, KD2VHC. Having started both people with, defibrillators and cars with tapping on the starter, sometimes you just got to rattle the instrument to make it go again. It's rare, but you give it your shot. That's what it is. I've done both and had success and failure with both.
Personally, for whatever reason, I have found banging something that isn't working worked a lot better back in the 60s and the 70s and maybe the 80s than they do now. I haven't been able to bring too much back by just giving it a thump. I try. I always give it that try.
A rally plug socket, that could help.
Oh, I got a good piece of humor you'll enjoy.
Okay.
So for a number of years, I worked with a guy who liked to say, if you can't fix it with a hammer, it's broke. So I sent my son to engineering school, and he comes back, and we were having a conversation one day, and I related that thought to him. And he's like, well, what about the other half of the thought? I went, what are you talking about? He says, there's a second half to that. He says, if you can't hit it with a hammer, it's broke. You know, if you can fix it with a hammer, it's broke. If you can fix it with a hammer, it's still broke. It's funny how simple ideas get lost in the ether, which while maybe it doesn't exist as a noun, it exists as a thought.
But you try and make the point, if you have to hit it periodically, it's still broke. In other words, you know, it ain't fixed until that stops happening.
Well, that's only part of it, but that's a big part of it. Yes. But it's bigger than that. It's a whole thinking process, which is what we're doing here, and I'm enjoying it tonight.
Guys, a quick queue in, man. I can't get in. This is N2BHC. Can I have a comment?
Certainly, Ken. I'm sorry that we all quick key. It's a bad habit.
Man, that other dude just cut me right off. I wanted to say about the electrical surgical unit. Laser isn't common in most general, operating rooms. That's a specialty item, right? So general operating rooms have electrical surgical units. Of course they have scalpels, right? But the electrical surgical unit's optimal because it cauterizes. You know, it's a standard item in all, operating rooms.
and that, and, you know, that transmits. I send Morse code on mine whenever I calibrate. Maybe there's somebody somewhere picking it up. I don't know. Depending where you place